Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? You get what you need. Oh. I got an interesting
email from a man who said, Carol, I am so distraught because I can't seem to do anything right. You know, I'm tricking myself into believing that I can potentially look at provocative images and not activate my sex addiction. But as you've said on many shows, that's just not true. What can I do? Well, the answer is simple, but I got to tell you, his name is Joe. I got to tell you, Joe, that clearly you're not willing to do the hard work right now. You're not ready to give it up. And it's written all over this email that you're asking a question that you already know the answer to. So I'm going to encourage you, Joe, to write down 25 reasons you don't want to give up your sex addiction. What are the issues? What's going on? Why are things not working for you? And I promise you, you will know, because you haven't given it 100%. And it is hard to give it 100%. You're acting like it's still your best friend, and it is your best friend. So when you look at visual images that are provocative in nature but don't rank under hardcore porn, perhaps they don't even rank up into soft porn, but they definitely stir your curiosity, your fantasy, and your objectification, you might as well be looking at porn, because it's the same thing, only different. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheep, a.k.a. Carol the Coach. And I don't know what up. Maybe it's spring, but I've got to tell you, I have sold so many online courses this last week. I promise you it's going to put me in retirement. And, you know, I can go 1 or 2 months with just selling a few, and I'm okay with that. I always say I like to work when I'm sleeping, because the truth of the matter is I work so hard. You know, I just finished up a workbook, Unleashing Your Power, and I just did a workshop, and I'm doing another book on helping couples heal and getting a certification together for clinicians and coaches all over the world to learn empathy and how to do early recovery couples work. Super exciting. But I also like to work when I sleep, which means I like to sell products while I'm dozing, while I'm snoozing. And last week was a record-breaking week for Help or Heal, the online course. And it just is a real easy way to relearn my book, learn my book for the first time, pretend you're in therapy with me, because it's like I'm talking to you on every module, telling you what you need to do to continue to have or gain good sobriety, as well as to help her heal. If you're lucky enough to be in a relationship, you've got some work to do. And I guess it could be spring. You know, there's many a man that has said to me, you know, I feel, Carol, like when it gets to be springtime, the clothes change, the images are more provocative, and I know I have to double duty up on my 3-second rule, my distractions, and my looking down at my feet as I walk through the street. Now, I would never have thought that I would work with a population that would really need to look down at their feet when they walk in the street, but the truth of the matter is they do, especially if they're somewhere like we here in Indianapolis have the Indy 500. And although it's a lot different than it used to be 20, 30, even 40 years ago, this is where women are scantily dressed, if dressed at all, and it's probably not a safe place for a sex addict to be. But if you love racing and you want to participate in an activity that has been part of your lifelong history, you got to strategize. You got to figure out, where am I going to sit? You're not going to sit in the infield. I mean, you can, but you better be saving that money up, because you shouldn't be sitting in the infield. The infield is dangerous for somebody like you. And then you need to have an accountability buddy. You need to have called somebody, and as my clients call it, bookend things. Call somebody before you get into the track and call somebody as soon as you leave the track. And report how you did and what worked for you and what maybe didn't work for you at all. I mean, that's super important, because when you set up your recovery tools to support you in sobriety, you will do a lot better. And I so badly want you to know that it is imperative for you to set up that structure. You can't do this being lackadaisical or complacent. It will never work for you. Now, you know this show is about sex addiction. It's about treatment. It's about partner betrayal. It's about couples. So I'm going to ask you right now, you know, what do you need as a recovering sex addict? Do you need more reflection time? More spiritual time? Do you need more recovery time? Do you need to go to more meetings? Maybe you need to change them up. Have you ever been to a Zoom meeting in the UK or Australia or Sweden? They're fun. They're exciting. They're different. They transform you a little bit differently. So what do you have to do to increase your recovery? Maybe that's you need to get more involved. I was just talking to a man earlier who had 9 days clean time, and then he went to a massage parlor on Mother's Day, no doubt. Very sad, very sad. But you know what? I suggested that he reach out to 3 people this week and ask them how they're doing and be their support person. And he actually had met somebody who's never been to a meeting. And I said, call him and get him to come to a meeting with you. And he said, you know, I'm just afraid that if I talk to him, if I really spend time chatting it up with him, he'll ask me about my recovery, and I will have to share that I don't have perfect recovery. Well, since honesty is at the foundation of personal recovery, you know what I think. I think you have to work your hardest to hold true to that principle first and foremost. And when you do, and you work it, it definitely works. Now, today, we are going to be talking to Michelle Safier, speaking about her work with partners struggling with betrayal trauma. And it's really interesting because she basically believes that women are faced with two choices. And she's going to talk about those two paths because one of them they have to choose. And so I had heard her response to something on our listserv, and I reached out to her and I said, hey, I want you to come on the show. I want you to talk about partners and how they should be celebrating their own wisdom, beauty, strength, and even their brokenness, right? So I will really look forward to her joining the show because she's got a lot of wisdom and she has a lot of knowledge about partner betrayal. So, Michelle, welcome to Sex Help with Carol the Coach.
Hi, Carol. How are you?
I am great. It's the beginning of the week and I'm ready to go. And, you know, there's nothing more that I love to talk about than partners and the betrayal that they've experienced and then empowering them to feel better about themselves along the journey. So tell me a little bit about how you got invested and involved in this work.
Well, that's a good question, or actually a good place to start. I've been doing this work for about 24 years, and I kind of happened into it as I worked in the same building as Rob Weiss. And so I just sort of happened in. And in working with these folks that were so traumatized, and at the time, we were seeing these traumatized partners as codependents, co-addicts, as one with a problem and that had some sort of involvement in what happened to them. And when I got that these were traumatized, these folks were traumatized, it stirred in me a passion to help and also for betrayed partners to be seen as traumatized people and help these traumatized people and not as, you know, codependent. So those that are in some way part of it.
Yeah, tell our listening audience, what would your definition of codependency be?
My understanding of codependency is through Pia Mellody's model, which is just kind of bringing it down to the simplest point, that one's ability to understand themselves, to manage their feelings, to feel confident and whole has to do with how the other sees them. So that people with, quote, codependency, I'm not a fan of labels, you know, kind of putting someone in that kind of box, because we are all so rich and unique in who we are. But just within that they're so that they may be overdoing or overfunctioning, but it's because in that framework it reduces their own distress.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And then, you know, you mentioned Rob Weiss, and a lot of people are now certainly referencing prodependence. Tell our listening audience what prodependence is.
Well, I'm not, Carol, you may be able to speak to that in a way that I'm not as tuned into Rob's perspective. I can tell you what it would mean for me, though, within the
That's
work that I
nuts.
Do.
So,
for me, to kind of bridge that over, right, when Rob and I were working together, all we had was that addiction model to understand, you know, family members. And we realized that there was a different process going on, and that these folks that were enduring trauma and distress, no invitation, you know, not wanting it, not inviting it, living their lives as best they could, and to then be seen as part of the problem, I think was it's distressing for us. And so the pro-dependence model, as I understand Rob's and certainly for myself, is that actually these are folks that love deeply. And when you love deeply, you hurt deeply. And so they're the perspective of one who is harmed and really taken by what's happened to them, and doing whatever they can to help themselves and their partner. I don't see that as problematic. Ultimately, it is problematic for the person, but I see it as coming from a deep love. And so in that way, there's an honoring and respecting of how one behaves when they are, when they discover something about the person they love and do their best to try to help them while in their midst of their own pain is a beautiful act of kindness, which ultimately causes.
I think that's a great definition. And, I know there's a lot of speculation of what does that really mean, and obviously we don't want to pathologize anybody, and you don't. That's why you didn't particularly want a label. But people that love addicts have typically been pathologized. So prodependence is another way to avoid that labelization or that pathology. Now I'm going to ask you, because yes. You know, you said you got your heart, you have a heart for partners, mm-hmm. and you've worked with partners for over a couple decades.
Mm-hmm.
What have you observed, you know, that has informed the way you work with partners today? Because you're working with them differently today than you were when you first started. Am I correct?
Absolutely. I remember when I first started, and we held that traditional addiction model, and partners were then seen as co-addicts, which kind of co-addict, codependence, those terms both have similarities. Then what we worked with them on was to stop behavior that we actually realized was their only way to find safety. You know, the checking and just all of the intense feelings that they had, the questions they had, all that we now understand is trauma-based, was being seen through the lens of addiction, and then with that lens, it's seen as enabling the other rather than trying to understand oneself, one's reality. So where I went with this was to really see that, yeah, that didn't work. It was terribly disrespectful to tell someone who was in crisis that what they were doing was contributing to their own crisis, but then worse, that it would cause their partner to act out, which is a terrible responsibility to give someone, in my opinion. when they're in the midst of their own crisis. So the shift at the first shift toward, well, let's understand what's happening to you and let's understand trauma because there's a lot of similarities. And so I began working in the trauma model with EMDR and all of the ways that we know that can help people who are traumatized to reduce that distress. And I wasn't satisfied with the help that it was providing. I didn't feel like it was enough help. So I started seeking other ways of helping people, and I did training in psychodrama, you know, all of these different ways to try to help people to feel what was happening to them. Because just talking about it, in my experience, just talking about it deepened the distress. There was never an end. There was never a healing that came from talking about it. And so understanding their reality, facing what's happening to them, seeking information, trying to understand who their beloved is or was, is so important. And yet it keeps folks stuck in the story. And there was a point at which there was not only stuck in the story, but then dependent upon their partner struggling with addiction to be sober, to do all of the things that we know are important. But we want the person to do that for themselves and not for the partner to be dependent on someone outside themselves to restore safety and balance.
So can I just check in for a second? Because obviously that safety is so very important. I mean, that is the first phase that a partner needs to work on and through as she's moving hopefully beyond partner betrayal. And so you really do see partners as having two primary paths that they can choose.
Mm-hmm.
And can you describe what those are?
Yes, absolutely. So my greatest concern was that partners were stuck in anger and helplessness. And the anger was keeping them embittered and discouraged and helpless and, you know, losing self. And so the guiding principle to me was, is this a story of your life or is this going to be the story of your life? And when I got that, okay, this can't be the story of someone's life, we need to help them use their own inner resources to heal themselves and not something outside themselves, their spouse or therapist, although your therapist is essential to the process. So what I saw was these two paths, one where they were continuing to have expectations and focus on how their partner is doing, how the betrayer is, and all that they're doing in their recovery in order to restore wellness. And that works. It's not to say that that's a failed process. It's to say that at the end of the year, 2 years, 5 years, the person with the addiction, having done their work, feels released and in many ways transformed, but not so for the partner whose work has been dependent on how well they've done, so to speak. So the path that I see is really what I consider to be like a heroic journey, that one is taking this, accepting whatever this is, looking into it, facing into it, and then learning about themselves, fighting everything, slips, disclosure, living through it all, but gaining their own tools to help themselves and depending on their internal world, their wisdom, their core, their resilience to get them through this crisis. And every step of the way, they're facing more and more about themselves and their marriage, and dealing with outside sources. What if their spouse or partner doesn't do the healing? What if the betrayer doesn't do the healing? So, Carol, what I saw was these folks, this coupleship, they were climbing out of this abyss of the destruction of discovery on the same ladder. The ladder, the partner is behind them, and if the addict slips, they both slip. And that was the condition in which it became the story of the person's life. So the path I like to take partners. Go ahead, Carol.
Well, I was going to say, that makes a lot of sense. And I want you to repeat what you said at the initially. You said, do you want that to be a story or your only story? How did you put that?
Right. Do you want this to be a story of your life or the story of your life?
Got it. Got it, because that can happen. Oh, I know, and that's what I fight, too. I mean, Michelle, I wrote Unleashing Your Power, which is to move them beyond partner betrayal and to get them to a post-traumatic growth state. If they give back because of their partner betrayal, good for them. But if they decide to do something that's totally separate from what they've been through and yet they feel really good about it, that's where we want everybody to be, but especially our partners who have been through so much and have wondered and questioned, could they get to the other side? So that's why I really loved what you had to say there, because we don't want it to be their story. It can be a part of their story, but it should not be who they are, because they're more than just a partner. And it sounds like you agree with me.
Right. Absolutely. We are absolutely have the same perspective. I want their story to change. And one of the guideposts in this process is I ask them to continue, to write their story at different points. Okay, what's the story of what happened? And through the work they do facing themselves, and I want to be sure and share with you a few of the ways in which I help partners through the crisis and even ongoing. But through that work, that they develop a relationship with their own wounded self, their angry part, all of these parts of them that have been traumatized. So that at the end of their journey, their story is a story of restoration, of an elevated sense of self, that this didn't happen to them, it happened for them.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's a hard one to swallow, because you have to go, it happened for me? What are you talking about? So tell us more. How can they think this didn't happen to me, it happened for me?
You know, Carol, what I find when I worked with partners previously, before I sort of understood this way of working was helpful, it did happen to them. It's true. It happened to them. They didn't invite it. They didn't invite this crisis. Many people in my experience had no idea, and that's true. And so that did happen to them. But as they go through the journey, what I wish for them to get through it is, as hard as it is, I see people there and it's extraordinary, that they come to a point of self-awareness where they say, I don't know if you've heard this, but I've had couples say, not for a few years, this was the best thing that ever happened to me. This was a gift. They realized they were surviving. Well, we all very much do, but they were unaware of how little they were actually getting, intimacy they were getting from their partner. We go about our life and we kind of wish for something and then we start continuing our life. Pardon me. And so, right? So in this way, we say, okay, what? Why did this happen? What's the meaning in the suffering? I've suffered for a reason. If there's no reason, then I'm just going to continue to suffer. If I can't make sense of it, if there's no purpose.
Yeah, so can you remember or cite a client who got to that point, and what contributed to that third phase, which is that restoration of self or of the relationship or, you know, of your relationship with your higher power? How did she know that she actually was a stronger person because of what had occurred in her life?
Very good question. And I have two stories. The first will be brief. I worked with a couple and a woman for about 2 or 3 years, and she was angry, embittered, understandably, with what happened. As hard as we worked, we couldn't get her to shift from that anger and, you know, what didn't make sense, right? All those questions, why did you do this? How could you do this? And she couldn't, it just was so important for her to be in that place and to hold that anger as a way of protecting herself from further harm. Ultimately, she left therapy, and then I heard from her 8 years later, and she was in the same place, worse, depressed, and, you know, worse, not sleeping, not eating. And that was really what shifted for me. So the story I can tell you is of a woman I worked with for about 4 years. And, of course, devastated. And her identity was connected to what her husband did, how he felt about her. You know, she had her own struggles, although very, very confident woman. And she hadn't realized how deferring she was to him and how actually little sense of her own self she had until the discovery that she faced, and she faced the feelings, the anger. And when she got there, she utterly alone in the universe, you know, that sense of like, I'm not tethered anywhere.
Yeah, isolation.
Total isolation, complete isolation.
Uh-huh.
And that's not a place that people like to stay. And that is so she hung on exercise by exercise, day by day, just staying with the feeling, staying with the fear, feeling her feelings, which she hadn't felt in many years. She hadn't allowed herself to feel scared. Because when we're facing it, it's not pretty to learn that your spouse has had 25 affairs in the 30 years of marriage. Never sober. And so for her, it was really a descent into what felt like an abyss of like not knowing herself and not knowing how to breathe and what was the next step. She was at that stage seeking, she was in group, and she would bring up something and ask group, what should I do? And we'd all say, wait a minute, find that part of yourself that knows what to do. So we would help her to see that she actually did have a part inside that had a core that she could hold on to. She, in the process, to her credit, she began doing meditation. She began taking yoga classes. And this is what's so cool about her. In the 3 years we worked together, she not only took yoga classes, she went into training and became a yoga instructor. And then when we were concluding treatment, she was doing retreats in Bali and, you know, she was flying all over the world doing retreats. She had a sense of competence, a sense of owning herself, of strength. She didn't get there without a whole bunch of terror and sessions where facing into the pain, it was like she came apart. She became undone. And so that last session, couple session, when she had done a retreat and she and her husband came with her, and she left the session, she said, you know what, I never thought I'd say this, but this was the greatest gift she could have had. She had a sense of self.
And, you know, I so get that. And, wow, to think that she went from probably total fracturing and feeling like her whole life was, was not real. She somehow got in touch with her strength, got in touch with what she wanted to do, which, Michelle, you and I both know, a partner's journey is to look at oneself and decide what will bring them joy, what will bring them meaning, and really focus back in on their life separate from the addict, right?
Absolutely.
So what was her connection to Bali? I mean, how do you go from being betrayed to traveling all over the world, including Bali, and doing retreats?
She, you know, this woman had her own childhood story, which we all do, and which I have to tell you, Carol, it feels respectful to me to see them as having been traumatized by what happened to them, and that in and of itself is a trauma without linking any childhood issues, because we all have issues. For her, she did have difficulties in her childhood, so it was even more unmooring to learn this about her husband. And so there was a deeper sense of, like, this existential crisis of self. And so she faced, it's almost like, it feels like kind of this journey of like facing two-headed dragons, you know, and, and monsters, and here's another thing. And around this corner is how my father treated me when I was a, you know, child. Okay, you slay that dragon. That's not the reason. That's an issue to face, as you said. Then you go around the bend and there's a monster there. Whatever that monster is, sexuality, was it femininity for women, identity for men and women. Now you slay that one. And so with each battle of self comes strength. And she held on. She floated back to her childhood and remembered issues when she was 5, 6 years old. But those became part of a story of resilience. So whereas they were to blame, you know, she had her family story as a way that part of her made sense of what happened to her. But as she went through her journey, she saw those as being battles that built was a strong woman that was able to risk. It was really risky for her to do a yoga class. She was so self-conscious. You know, her body image and her femininity, all sense of self. So to put herself out there and be seen in these positions, she became, that was the beginning of an empowerment. The way she moved her body, that she did it on her own, that it was her choice regardless of what her betrayer believed. And so it was through that little process that she gained a sense of her own value that was always there, right?
You know, I love hearing these stories because it does remind partners and even the addicts that are listening to today's show that's what we all want for someone who's been through so much trauma. And you and I both know that trauma is not always somebody's story, but more oftentimes than not it is, whether it's the trauma of having been betrayed or traumas before the betrayal even occurred. And, you know, post-traumatic growth or restoration of self is so important to anybody's journey. And so if you're an addict listening to today's show, I know if you're in relationship with somebody, you want that for your partner. But I'm going to also encourage you to imagine what you could do to feel good about yourself. You know, Patrick Carnes said it best, Michelle, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, suffering, great suffering leads to transformation, and that leads to giving back. When you give back, you've come full circle in your journey of meaning, of what you can do when something serious has happened, and you're no longer defined by it, you're defined by its growth.
Absolutely. And, you know, I see the people struggling with sex addiction as being on a heroic journey as well. Well, they are, when that discovery happens, I see that they also have a choice. The one path is the checking, you know, kind of going, if they choose to engage in treatment or in meetings, it's to just get by and to, you know, just stabilize the home. And there are those that take the call to action, and they get on what I see as a hero's journey, very much like the Odyssey, where they're in a shaky boat alone, and there's some allies along the way, you know, 12-step meetings, therapist, sponsor. But they're fighting their own inner parts that have kept them so isolated that they lost their sense of connection to humanity for many. And so I see they're both on the separate journey, but it's a journey of it's a journey into self. You know, something occurred to me a bit ago, Carol, that this, in my belief, this is an attachment trauma. We talk about betrayal trauma. This is an attachment trauma for partners. And in many ways, for the person struggling with sex addiction, they are in, being in a relationship in many ways feels like trauma, attachment trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So I do see that they're both on, I don't see one as bad, you know, bad and good, right and wrong, an addict and a partner. I see them two wounded people who are trying to understand themselves and as best they can on their own journey with respect and dignity toward the other. Not dependent on the other for safety, security, being seen, being validated, empathy. Of course, we want all of that. But ultimately, in this part of the journey of self, we have to be able to find our own source.
Well, I agree with you 100%. You know, I love that you call it the hero's journey, because obviously that is a phrase that has been used in many, many, many books. And our addicts that get healthy and our partners that get strong, they are heroes. And so, Michelle, mm-hmm. as we end today, what might you add in terms of to our listening audience, what might you add to give them some hope, strength, and recovery?
What I would add for the partner is mm-hmm. the that in that crisis, so the anger is what I wish for people to overcome. You know, that's the first dragon. And so what I wish for them in that crisis state is that they're able to help themselves through it, you know. With for me, I teach breathing exercises and the different ways that EFT, emotional freedom technique, to help reduce their distress, and all of the ways that moving their body, small meditations, ways of grounding themselves and centering themselves by rubbing their hands together and feeling the friction so that they're back in their body, that all of these helping themselves in that very beginning phase, feeling the anger, but when they've been able to come to their own rescue when they were in emergency, then anger is another phase, not the lifeline to hold on to, that if I'm angry, then I'm alive. If I'm angry, then I'm safe.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
My wish is that they can release that anger, find forgiveness for themselves. And what I would wish for the betrayer or the person struggling with sex addiction to know is to hold a perspective of compassion, and that when they're struggling, you know, in the crisis and questions and they're trying to make sense of their reality, that they're able to hold that with a compassionate heart and with a compassionate heart and a relaxed body, they can tolerate the partner's pain without defensiveness, without feeling attacked. The key is the relaxed body, and that comes with meditation and breathing, body scans, and, you know, kind of the breathing work that we do, the deep yoga breath, and to have compassion for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And so,
and
have
a,
you know, I know
really low expectations.
Lower expectations, yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, your approach makes so much sense, and it is so important when you're dealing with partners to really help them learn some of the simple techniques to ground and resource to get them to be able to actualize mm-hmm. their potential. I got one more question for you. I want to ask mm-hmm. you, you and I both believe in couples work, and yet
mm-hmm.
so many therapists do it right after discovery. What is your feeling about that?
You know, I am a strong believer in couples therapy and in healing relationships. So I kind of have a bias toward connection and healing, but an understanding
uh-huh.
that it's not always possible. and pardon me. And so, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
Issue, pardon me. And Carol, I am so sorry. I had a little, I have allergies over here in Pennsylvania. And can you ask the question again? I'm terribly sorry.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
I
know that you and I do couples work, and so many therapists jump right into couples therapy after a discovery. And what's your belief or thought about that?
Thank you. I mm-hmm. believe that the couple needs to have some experience on their own journey, particularly that beginning of learning how to regulate themselves and how to manage the stress and anxiety and fear and the parts of the self that are so wounded and terrified that they can't handle anything from the other. I believe there needs to be a sense of managing that before couples therapy can be effective. So I believe having a couple in to have the boundaries and just sort of what's the framework of healing is, to me, it's vital for the partner to understand that there's a process. And yet, if couples therapy started too soon, the both people, but really the betrayer, who doesn't have a sense of their internal world, because that's what addiction is. It's a rescue from the distress of the inner world. They're not going to be able to tolerate what comes up. And if people are in therapy, if a person struggling with addiction is in early recovery and they're in a distressing situation, marital distress with the demands for intimacy, the expectations of intimacy, the pain, they're not going to be able to handle it. And what do people with addiction do when they can't handle the intense distress? They act out. So I like
Great
to hold. We want success.
There you go.
There,
Michelle, I have to end, but you have been so helpful in guiding our partners and even addicts through this process and this journey. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your hope for a future. I really appreciate it.
Carol, thank you so much for having me on your program today. And you should know there are many people, my clients, that listen to your program and get so much from it. So thank you for doing this for our community. What you contribute to our community is amazing. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's an in-service every week, so I love it. I get educated. I get to find out about the professionals out in the world, and I can tell we're kindred spirits, so keep up the great work, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Carol. Be well.
Uh-huh. Be well. Okay. It is time to end, but as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times, and fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll catch you next week for more Sex Help with Carol, the Coach.